Howdy, howdy.
Howdy.
That just doesn't sound right.
No, it doesn't, does it? Howdy. Howdy, partner.
Partner.
It's not getting better.
G'day, mate. Throw another shrimp on the barbie for you.
That sounds good. That's I like closer. That right there, yeah. Hello, and welcome to episode 116 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, today joined by Fosma Mood and Seth Miller, as well as Josh Zepps, host of the podcast We the People Live, available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and wherever good podcasts are found. Hey, Josh.
Hello, Americans, and all wonderful listeners. Did that sound forced? Did that sound like I was hamming up my Australianism
too much? It was a little contrived. Sorry.
Okay. Howdy, partners. Good to be here.
Oh, so you guys are all in New York, New Jersey, you three, and I'm in Portland, and I think it's equally hot everywhere. So we're going to try to make this a quick show so we can turn our ACs back on and get through it a little bit.
The thing is that by the time people are listening to this, they can already see how long the show is. So the only people in the world who don't know how long the show is the four of us.
We don't know how long we're going to be in pain is what you're saying.
It's hot. It's very, very hot.
The first thing up is the dot, and this week's dot is Orlando. And Seth, you found this and you thought it was interesting because there's a lot of interesting things going on with what Orlando wants to do with their runways and an expansion of the terminal, right?
Yeah, so the gist of it is a $1.8 billion project, which anytime you start talking about things that big, it gets crazy. But they want to add a whole new terminal on the south side of the airport. And currently, all the access goes through the north side. You sort of drive from the north down into the top of the airport, and then some of the stuff you can loop around on internal roads and such. But basically, everything comes from the north, all the highways and whatnot. And putting this on the south side, one of the things they're trying to do is add a major intermodal transport sort of setup. So basically what that means is a rail station. And to me, it's just kind of amazing that somehow someone in Florida thinks rail is actually going to work.
Can I just ask a novice question? Does that mean that a rail system that's going to link into some kind of public transit rail system or simply a rail system that's internal to the airport?
So they want three different options. One is this light rail service over to the International Drive area. It's called SunRail. SunRail is something else. The light rail service that goes to the International Drive. So that would be the local bit. And then Brightline is the name of the high-speed rail down to South Florida. It's one of those things that if you look at the map and whatnot, it sort of seems like Orlando, Miami, Tampa, that section of the country has enough people and is short enough distances that high-speed rail should work.
Mm.
And so in theory, that'd be great. But it's also one of these crazy things where it's going to be private development. It's not clear who's going to ever use it. You still have to rent a car whenever you get to wherever you're going, almost certainly, especially if it terminates out at the airport. So, yes, it's going to be interesting.
My guess is they're just going to extend the Disney monorail.
Well, to be fair, I mean, I hear people talk a lot about the possibility of high speed rail in South Florida in the same way they always speak about it in Southern California as well. You can imagine a rail link between San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Jose, Sacramento, maybe. But is there actually any money in this project to go towards something like that to actually link up cities, or are they linking the airport? Because I can also imagine just a good rail system that links Orlando, Disney World, and the airport.
Yeah, and I happen to think that that would be more useful at this point. The building of the intercity stuff is a private enterprise, believe it or not, because, those always work great for major infrastructure projects.
God bless America, where even high-speed rail is private.
Yeah, it's unclear to me whose money they're borrowing to fund it that'll then get, lost when they go bankrupt. But it's going to be a private. My understanding is it's all private for that aspect of things.
Interesting. I like the one feature that they featured in the article. Like they said it's going to have indoor palm trees, which is, I mean, that's important. it's just really
nothing screams classy like indoor palm trees.
Yeah,
so you don't get confused and think that you're in Anchorage.
No, the screaming kids remind me exactly where I am.
Yeah, I also like that in the article towards the top, the project's expense surpasses the $2.3 billion being spent on widening and rebuilding 21 miles of Interstate 4. So I-4 is the main through east-west thoroughfare in that part of the country, and 21 miles for $2.3 billion.
Let's do the math on that. What is that a mile?
100 million?
100 million a mile. Wow.
Did I do that right?
I think so. Yeah, I think you're pretty darn close. And that reminds me of the
I-10.
Yeah, it reminds me of the I-10 project in Houston. I mean, that's about the same cost. So.
I mean, it's to be fair, you're fixing, building, widening, whatever, a completely developed area. It's not like there's spare space to have. But
and in the article, they say that they're out of space. I mean, is it that packed at Orlando? I haven't flown through Orlando.
At the airport?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the terminals are pretty much a zoo. And it's growing. I mean, in terms of service, in terms of trying to get new flights and stuff, it actually continues to be a growing operation. There was discussion, I think, at one point of trying to roll some of the Sanford stuff down there to ease things, ease airspace, and just sort of consolidate everything. But it's a growing operation. It's getting more and more international flights. Even, you know, it's at this point between Orlando and Miami, it's almost overflow, depending on how close you are.
Yeah, because doesn't Orlando have TAM flights and things to Brazil?
Yeah, yeah. They have a couple TAM. They've got a Delta flight to Brazil.
Now that's random. That's definitely the dartboard coming to play.
Yeah, they're still running it. that one's been around a year or two now. Now there's a lot of southbound service out of there. So there's some interesting there are a bunch of interesting routes in and out of Orlando, but it's a growing market. And
is that market, Seth? Is that a leisure market because of Disney World, or what's going on?
It's both. It's very high leisure traffic.
You can say leisure. That's all right. I forgive you.
You can translate. Yeah, a lot of it is leisure, but there's still business being done there. I mean, whether associated with the resorts or not, it's a relatively large business market, and it is absorbing a lot of that from Miami. People sort of fleeing northward out of the crazy. It's a little easier. It was, you know, it's like many things. Miami was pushed up against the shore, and you were basically waterbound. So getting real estate was expensive. It was hard. It was, you know, all of those challenges. And you could move a little further north and get more space and all those things. And eventually that just kept moving. And at some point, you know, after you get to Palm Beach or so, it's like, well, dang, why don't I just go north instead of going all the way back down to Miami? So.
Well, we'll see. Is it approved? Are they actually going to do this? Or is this something that's just like on the possibilities list?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. Reading this, all but rubber stamped.
That's how I read it. It was like, it's ready to go.
That's what they put in the headline. That's the lead. So okay. I hope you read it the same. There's nothing we can see to stop this, said Philip Brown, executive director of the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority.
A hurricane, maybe.
Yeah. Well, he called it a black swan event. I think even a hurricane wouldn't be the problem so much as a major financial shift in the global markets in like the next 6 months.
Yeah. Josh, you recently took a trip to Hong Kong via JFK Munich Bangkok on a mix of Lufthansa and Thai, and you wanted to talk about that as your lines, and I want to hear a little bit about this because it sounds like it was an interestingly last minute booked trip.
Yes, it was. So I knew I needed to go to Australia, so why not go via Hong Kong, Bali, Bangkok, and Munich? And I'd burned points on first class, and it was one of those situations where I knew I had to go at some point in the next week, and Lufthansa availability opens up pretty close in, and there was availability in first class from JFK to Munich that same day, and I was like, screw it, let's just take that and go. The problem was the connecting flight in Thai from Munich to Bangkok was already under airport control, so I couldn't see a seat map to tell whether or not it was one of their new 747s or the old 747s. But I took a bet. I decided to take it. I knew that it would be an A380 from Hong Kong from Bangkok to Hong Kong. And the contrast of transiting from Lufthansa first to Thai first, and we can get a little bit into Thai first. I know you guys mentioned Thai on the last episode. I have a conflicted relationship with Thai Airways. Lufthansa was basically, I mean, I think they may offer the best first class in the world. I mean, the attention to detail, they have this German precision, the finesse is impeccable, the dining is like eating at a 3 Michelin star restaurant. I mean, it is so superb. So I get to Munich, I spent the morning sleeping in the lounge, and then boarded the flight, and just as I left, I asked the lady about the seat map, and I found out it was one of the old 747s, which are by now very old inside. The amazing thing about the interior of the old Thai 747s is there's so much empty, unused space, and the seats aren't huge. Like, they do recline into beds, but they're old seats, and there's just a tremendous amount of, like, unused space in the nose. So I sit down, and the purser, who seems to be one of those very, very, very old Thai gentlemen, like, you know how, I don't mean to be like racist here, but allow me to be racist here. You know how sometimes you will find that a Southeast Asian gentleman will look like he's 15 and then all of a sudden look like he's 80, but there's no in between. It's just like they look either like the youngest people in the world or the oldest person you've ever seen. This was the oldest person I've ever seen in my life. And he comes up, welcomes everyone on board, and brings out a bottle of Dom Perignon. And bear in mind, I'm coming off the back of Lufthansa First, the most where everything is incredibly polished. This guy comes out with a bottle of Dom Perignon, shakes it up, pops the bottle, which smashes onto the ceiling, and says, "Who is ready to party?"
That's not what he really said.
That is absolutely 100% verbatim.
Oh, my God. I think I would have asked to leave the plane. Can I deboard myself?
Screamed it at the top of his lungs and then comes around and starts pouring champagne. It turned out to be his final flight. And so throughout the entire flight, the whole first class service was videotaped on an iPhone by another colleague of his. So there was never a sense of privacy. Most of the flight attendants were always milling around regardless of what happened in that sort of, again, that rather Thai way where when you go into a department store, there are always 50 employees for every shopper, and that you're never quite sure what they're all doing there. And there's a lot of milling around, and like at restaurants, there was a lot of that in first class. I know this is first world complaints. Then I get off in Bangkok, endure what I think is the most overrated ground experience in Bangkok. I know that everybody loves raving about the free massage at the lounge there, but I didn't have time for the massage. And again, all I want in a lounge is sort of to be left alone and to be able to do my own thing. And when I want something, to be able to get it. But when you want something there, you can never get precisely what it is. You're constantly being hassled by people offering you things. I know, good problems to have, but I was just over it. I was too tired for it. And then had a lovely flight on the A380 to Hong Kong.
With a normal-aged crew?
A normal-aged crew. And that was
forget age, normal behaved.
Normally.
yeah, normal behaved. And also normally decked out plane. Like the first on the Thai A380 is actually really nice. And it's just stark contrast to the 747. It's so old.
Now, you said your Lufthansa experience, you know, it's the best first class experience that you've ever had. And you would rate this better than, say, Etihad and the first departments?
So I've done Etihad First 5 times, 3 of which were apartments and the others which were on 777s. And I've done Lufthansa 3 times, only once on the old setup where they used to have a bed that was next to your chair. So you would literally get – I mean that was probably the best flight I've ever had. You get out of your big plush Lazy Boy style chair and onto a bed that's between the chair and the window. So the bed can be a good bed, and the chair can be a good chair. I mean, that seems to me to be the most logical solution to the perennial problem of sleeping on planes, which is that what makes the most comfortable chair doesn't necessarily turn into the most comfortable bed. What was the question again? Better than Etihad. Oh yeah, how would I rank them? I mean, I think the difference is Etihad apartments is the hard product is obviously amazing because you have so much room. You've only got, you know, it's one by one on an A380, so you've got your own room with your own bed and chaise lounge and sort of, you know, large plasma TV. But I actually find that layout a little bit alienating. I kind of like feeling like there are other people on the plane with me somehow. I like being able to see, look around. I don't like just being on my own. So I actually sort of prefer having a sense of space. And then secondly, the Lufthansa staff, the flight attendants are just so, I mean, it really does feel like you're in a fine dining restaurant, whereas Etihad, whilst friendly and whilst, you know, doing their best, there are little things that just sort of slip through the cracks, like not having your water or wine refilled or, you know, running out of food or whatever, just small little things. So I actually think that all round, the most polished experience is Lufthansa that I've had. I haven't flown Singapore First, though.
Interesting.
But I've flown Cathay quite a bit, and I like them too.
I've done Singapore First. I would say it is very polished.
I'm sure.
I found it miles ahead of Emirates First. Both of them were 380 suites. It was just much more polished, much more professional experience to me. Definitely not as luxe, I would say. It wasn't as shiny and whatnot, but
yeah,
a far more pleasant experience to me.
I mean, I actually found that I've had that some of my best Etihad first class flights have been on the 777s. I've just enjoyed those more. There's something about, just feeling like you're having an experience with other people where you're being pampered rather than being in an isolation, solitary confinement chamber where you're being pampered.
Well, I think like for me, the Lufthansa First piece, that what I like is the ground transfer. And you said you didn't like it in Bangkok. You don't like the whole rigmarole of getting on the cart and being driven around. I can't really imagine that because I've never done it. But I like the fact that I can get off a Lufthansa flight and kind of leisurely make my way to wherever I want to go. If I'm going to the first class terminal in Frankfurt or if I'm going to the lounge in Munich, whatever I want, it's kind of at my own pace.
Yeah, I think that suits my personality better as well. I don't like being fussed over, and if I'm going to be fussed over, it'd better bloody work. Like, it'd better really work. I'd better, because I've had experiences in Bangkok where I'll get off the plane and then they insist, because my name is on a board, that I get on one of those little carts, but then they have to wait for presumably someone who's a high-status passenger who was in coach.
Yeah.
To come off, and then so then I'm waiting for everyone to get off to disembark. Well, in that time, I would have just rather walk by myself. And I've had experiences where, like, I think it was at Abu Dhabi, and I think this was actually an Etihad experience where, because I was flying first, I was escorted by somebody who really didn't do anything. Like, there weren't sufficiently long lines for priority security that he was assisting in any way. But I had to spend 20 minutes just walking alongside the guy from check-in all the way to the lounge. And so I would have rather just listened to a podcast and, you know, and browse, but I felt awkward making chit-chat with somebody the whole way. I prefer a hands-off approach.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, I had a similar in Doha once where we did the sort of premium arrivals experience. And it was, again, by the time they figured out who everybody was that was supposed to be part of the group and then did the walk and everything else, and then we were waiting to figure out how we were going to deal with immigration. Part of that was the group thing, not just the, you know, arrivals experience. But I actually, one of the times I did, I finally went up to someone and was like, I'm leaving now. I'll take a taxi to where I need to be. If there's any problems, here's my phone number and someone can call me. And I left the group because I couldn't handle it anymore. I was like, after 14 hours on a plane, I would like to go take a shower and get some food and go to sleep. And you have me sitting here in this arrivals lounge that doesn't have any alcohol. And that's just not helping the situation.
I mean, can I just ask a question about lines and your preferences as well? On JFK, I'm always conflicted about this. When you're flying from the East Coast to Europe, what the value add of a premium cabin experience is when it's a red eye anyway, and why there aren't more daytime flights. I don't know if there are. I mean, I much prefer flying during the day because that brief six to 7 hour flight, it ruins me whatever class I'm in.
I wish there were more of them as well. I actually wrote about that the other day for Runway Girl. The reality is there's far too few of them make sense financially because most people don't consider it a wasted day.
Mm. And, well, it is a wasted day, but I mean, at least you don't. At least it's not a wasted night in which you didn't get to sleep.
Right. Well, I guess the question then becomes: is when you're on that red eye flight, do you stay up and have the dinner and do all those things, or do you just put the bed down and go to sleep?
I must say that I'm usually tempted by a couple of glasses of wine and a nice meal. Otherwise, what's the point?
Because it's got a bed.
Well, then the thing is, Seth,
right. I mean,
so you say it's a wasted day, like if it's a daytime flight. But the thing is that if you don't get enough rest on the flight, your next day is wasted.
Yeah. I mean, am I wasting today or tomorrow? And yeah. You know, are you gambling that tomorrow might not be wasted because you might sleep on the 6 hour flight to London, so you might get 4 hours of sleep?
I'm convinced that like the West Coast midday flights that they use to Europe are some of the worst because they leave at like 1 o'clock our time. And yeah, it's 4 o'clock on the East Coast, but it's only another couple of hours on the plane. So I land in Europe when it's 9 p.m., 11 p.m., or whatever it is in Europe, and that's rough. I think the last times we've been to Europe now together have been the two worst times since I've lived on the West Coast. I'm usually pretty good when leaving from Houston or the East Coast. I can do okay. But the West Coast have just beat me up.
The worst for me is the East Coast ones that leave at like 6 p.m. or 6:30 p.m. and get in, you know, around midnight or 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. East Coast time. But it's the morning already over there, and then you're expected to do a full day. I don't mind it so much if I get the last flight out of JFK, then I'm at least tired enough to get some sleep, and then it lands at sort of 11:30 in the morning, and I, you know, before I know it, it's time to go to bed. But it's those early ones that are just brutal.
Maybe we should ask Foz, because he's been doing a lot of European trips recently.
I just did San Francisco de Gaulle, which leaves San Francisco at 2:45, which just sucks because it's so early. And like it's earlier than the 6 o'clock on the East Coast at that point. But you get in at 10, which is an okay time, but I would much rather – I mean, I've done both the early and the late San Francisco Heathrow. The late one I like much more, even though you get in at, after like 1 o'clock or something. But you at least get to sleep.
That's important. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I've got my next one is going to be the 12 hours to Asia in coach, and I'm pretty sure I'm screwed no matter what on that.
What are you doing?
ANA coach, JFK Narita.
Ooh.
I mean, the thing that I also don't understand is why the flights back, at least particularly on United, leave so early in the morning.
Out of Europe?
Yeah. I mean, most of them are in the air by 10 a.m. It's like, what's the rush? If you're like, if they push those out a little further, then they can push the flights back to Europe later in the day. And I mean, I just don't understand the urgency to get them back and forth so quickly.
The only thing I can think of is they're trying to make it so people can get to 9 a.m. meetings.
Maybe to connect to the West Coast or something, if those are East Coast flights. I've always wondered that as well, because it prevents you. I mean, I've had several occasions within the past 8 months or so where I've had to take multiple flights within Europe just because there wasn't a ward space to connect to my transatlantic flight. And I had to get up at 3:30 in the morning to make a couple of flights, you know, to make the transatlantic that was going to depart, late morning at best.
And going westbound like that, it's even rougher on your body, because then it's still like midnight or 9 p.m. when you're getting up, and you try to sleep, but it's a daytime flight, so everybody's up and about doing whatever. And so then you land, and you're like, well, I need to go to bed now. And it's 10 a.m.
I don't think people are landing at 12:30 and rushing off to work.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right, yeah.
It's an interesting conundrum. I mean, the European airlines do the same thing. It's not like it's an American airline, a U.S. airlines issue.
That's not most of the European carriers fly out later in the day and turn around for 2 hours, 3 hours, because their overnight is here,
yeah.
Right? They're just turning the aircraft. They're not sending it elsewhere. So for them, it's a different story.
Yeah, it's the same 2 hour turn, but they do it on this side.
Exactly.
Yep. So they can afford to leave their hub a little later, and they're bringing the aircraft in from Asia or the Middle East or Africa in the case of Brussels, and then has a two-hour connection there, becomes 11, noon, 1. If you're Lufthansa, you've got the second bank up till 5, late flight, and then it does the turn here.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of like late flights out of Europe. I guess the Frankfurt-Houston's pretty late. The summer Frankfurt-San Francisco leaves pretty late. There's the London flights.
The London flights are definitely the latest. Frankfurt has a couple. There's a Dulles and a JFK that are both after 5 p.m. local time.
Yep.
I've taken both of those and love them. Taking the late Heathrow flights a few times too. Those are a little harder. You don't land till 11 p.m. New York time. That's a rough day.
I like those though. If you're in business or first, because you can sleep on the plane and then you get off. You can have half of your night sleep on the plane and then half of your night sleep in a bed. And even if you wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning, you're good to go for the next day. I'm also interested in asking you guys about the value add of being in a premium cabin on those East Coast red eyes, or on a short red eye or an early red eye out of the West Coast. I know that Seth, you're a crazy man who can do long economy class travel and still enjoy it, but. For me, it's a trickier proposition. When I on this the end of this trip that I was just talking about that I just took with Thai and Lufthansa, I went to Bali for a week, and then from Bali to Sydney, I was kvetching for a long time about exactly how I was going to do that, and then I ended up just buying an economy class Jetstar ticket for like $180 or something for a 5.5 hour red eye from Denpasar to Sydney on a 787 Dreamliner. Popped a sleeping pill when I got on. It was totally fine. And I was like, you know what? I actually don't care. If it's going to be a horrible red eye anyway, I don't care what cabin I'm in.
And now you understand how I do it.
But if it's a longer flight for me to sleep on, then I do care.
Yeah, I know. But if you tell yourself it's going to be shitty, you resign yourself that it's going to suck, and you got to put up with it and get through, and you'll deal with, you'll recover over the next 3 days after you get there. It takes on a much different attitude than, oh my gosh, this is going to be the best flight ever. I can't wait to eat and drink and lounge and whatnot. So,
I traveled to the East Coast quite a bit doing red eyes for a while on PS service, and I literally would get on that plane and as soon as we took off, I was in bed position and sleeping. And it was still rough, but I at least slept. Like, the guy next to me, most of the flights, every time, I swear, every flight, the guy next to me would have, like, the meal. I'm like, it's 11 o'clock at night. Like, what do you – maybe you didn't eat after work or whatever, but the rest of us want to sleep. And he's the one guy doing it. So I wouldn't eat the breakfast. I wouldn't do any of that. I just slept the entire time. And I came out okay. But I think the worst is – red eyes, transcon red eyes that are in domestic first. Like, I see no value add there. Like,
absolutely.
That's just put me in the coach seat, because it's the same damn thing. Everyone's miserable. Like, we're all in this together. It's going to suck. So, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I also hate it when the captain comes on and says, we've got some great tailwinds, a short flight time of 4 hours and 20 minutes. And you're like, oh, damn it. Can we circle around for a while? we're trying to get sleep. I don't want a short flight.
the last thing I want to hear on a red eye, it's a short flight. Yeah. Tell me it'll be longer.
I mean, I wish I had your diligence to put the bed down and just go straight to sleep. I remember Seth mocking me a few years ago when I tried, well, it may or not have been a few years ago. When did JetBlue Mint come out? Whenever that first came out, I was on.
Two years.
Yeah, and I was like, I couldn't really get enough sleep. But, you know, my complaint was that it took them too long to serve a meal and a drink after takeoff from Los Angeles because it didn't leave enough time to sleep. And Seth was like, you had a meal and a drink? Why didn't you just go straight to sleep? But yeah. I feel like if I'm in a premium cabin, I kind of want a little bit something more than just sleep. I mean, maybe this is just, like, me being selfish, but it feels weird to not want a little bit of pampering quickly.
I get it. I mean, it would have been nice to stay up. I knew that I had to be at work. Like, I had to rent a car at JFK and then drive to wherever I was going in New York City to go to work for the rest of the day, and I was going to be working until 7 p.m. So for me, it was like, do I want to be miserable, you know, when I land, or, you know, get a decent night's rest when I get there? So that was really it. I just killed that conversation. Done.
No, it makes sense.
I have a question for you, though, Josh. So now with this Thai experience and that you've experienced Thai so many times, do you think you'll continue to book them? I mean, it doesn't sound like you enjoy it. It sounds like it's kind of mediocre and almost like you kind of regret using the miles for it. Is that impression wrong?
That is only true on that particular flight on their old product. I will be very careful not to book the old product again. I used to fly when I was a kid and at my adolescence, I flew Thai a lot because they used to have, I don't know if they still do, that Sydney to Auckland flight. And I'm half New Zealand. My mum's a New Zealander. So they had really cheap fares. And they would actually quite often, when I was a little kid, have operational upgrades. And we would get them because I looked cute. And so I have a sort of a soft spot for Thai. And I also like transiting Bangkok if there is any opportunity to do so, not because of the lounge, but because I like to try to spend 23 hours in Bangkok. And I just enjoy being in that city. What better place to have a layover? So I would continue to enthusiastically travel Thai on long haul in the A380, but in terms of regional stuff and the old 747s, forget it.
So with them potentially coming back to the United States, potentially, with a nonstop to Bangkok, would that you're enticed by that, you're intrigued?
Yes. I mean, what else would you do to get to Bangkok? I mean, that would be a solid option because they're also one of the few airlines that offer consistent award space in a premium cabin between Asia and Australia. So if you're talking about using Aeroplan miles or United miles, you know, some kind of Star Alliance currency, being able to get from – if I lived in Los Angeles and they relaunched an LA to Bangkok nonstop and I was able to connect that to Bangkok to Sydney, that would be absolutely wonderful. Yes.
Yeah. No, I'd completely agree with that. They're not my favorite product by any stretch, but – it's a very good product. Even in economy, I've actually had some very nice flights with them long haul. And it's always good availability.
Mm. Oh, I should also add, there's also a big difference in business class. I took a 40-hour long trip from New Zealand back to New York the year before last. And that was Malaysia Airlines from Auckland to KL. And then I think it was Thai hop to Bangkok and then Bangkok to would it have been Tokyo and then Tokyo to JFK? It was something like that. Anyway, one of the Thai flights was their old angled. Why did we ever have angled seats? They're so much less comfortable than just having a big comfortable recliner seat. Anyway, don't get me started on that rant. But one of them was on an angled seat, and then the other one was on their new business class, which was fully lie flat, and that was a fantastic flight. And again, a big difference.
Interesting, because they have the angled flat, or they used to at least on the 747s, right? That's like the big – they still have it, I think, on some of them.
They definitely still have it somewhere. Yeah, I'm not familiar with what they've upgraded and what they haven't.
Yep. Last up is the destination, and you wanted to talk about India. We let you choose as the special guest today,
Josh. I'm honored and privileged.
And you had some insights on India, so I'll let you have the floor.
So this is sort of part of sort of the same line. After my trip to Australia, I was in Australia for most of February and March, and then coming back – it was during the American Airlines devaluation, or I guess just before it. So I wanted to burn a few American Airlines miles on Etihad first. And in order to maximize the amount of time that I was in a first-class cabin, I figured, why not just find somewhere that falls into the Middle East/South Asia band that has first-class service from Abu Dhabi and take the Sydney to Abu Dhabi A380, connect to a 777, and go somewhere that will still be fun. And that somewhere just happened to be Mumbai. And I had left HuffPost Live, and I had where I was working for the past 4 years, and I had a lot of time on my hands. So I thought, what better way to reframe one's mind and have a peaceful experience than by gazing out over the lakes of Udaipur in India? Of course, I was a complete idiot because you can't do anything peaceful in India at all. It's incredibly hectic and everything goes wrong. There's an old saying that in India, like nothing works, but everything can be arranged. But in Japan, everything works and nothing can be arranged. And India strikes me as one of those places where if you've got a few months and you're okay with just sort of arranging stuff on the fly and accepting that nothing's going to function, then it's great. But expecting to go there for 6 days, spend one night in Mumbai, do a tour of the world's largest slum, get back on a flight to Udaipur, spend four relaxing days there, then fly from Udaipur to, I don't even remember, Ahmedabad, and then connect in one night in Ahmedabad back to Delhi, and then have a tour in Delhi, and then fly out on Jet Airways and connect to Etihad to New York.
There was no way that was going to work well.
Why did I think that was going to be a relaxing post-work break?
If all the flights worked, that was a lot.
Yeah, that's right. And the flights, to be fair, did work. It's just all of the stuff around the flights, like the airports and so many layers of bureaucracy and crazy rules. Like, to get inside the airport, you need to have a copy of your boarding pass.
You can't show them on your phone. You need a paper printout. They all have a booth outside where they'll print it for you. Six times.
Ahmedabad Airport did not have a booth outside at four in the morning that was operating. So I needed a paper copy of my boarding pass, and I kept pointing at the check-in desk. I was like, that's where they give you the boarding pass. That's why they have check-in desks. But there was security to get to the check-in desk, and you needed to already be checked in and have a paper boarding pass before you get to the check-in desk. So I just walked confidently through, and the men with machine guns let me.
Oh, the joy of being Australian.
I that, like, if you're on your carry-on bag and your boarding pass, you get they put a special tag, you know, like just a name tag or whatever on your carry-on bags in India. But when you go through security, it gets stamped, and that's proof that it went through security. And then boarding pass, depending on the airline and the airport, I think it was in Ahmedabad as well, my boarding pass between the security checkpoint and standing on the plane, it was checked five times.
Wow.
And two of which were 8 feet apart at the boarding gate by two different security groups.
But did they remove your water bottles like they do in Hong Kong?
There are a lot of checks, but I don't think they've got the memo that a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. And there are a lot of weak links, right? Like, in terms of those, so they put a sticker, as you say, Seth, on your bag after it's gone through the X-ray. And this is for that's the checked baggage screening process before you get to check your bag.
So there's that one, and you get one for carry-ons.
And you get one for carry-on as well. So what happened after I had gotten through the men with machine guns, I then just walked past the X-ray. There were two banks of X-rays on either side of each other where people were just waiting. Passengers were waiting and feeding their bags into the X-ray machines while many sort of airport security gentlemen and ladies stood around. And I just walked confidently past them, went up to check-in, checked in, and as I walked away from check-in, wondered whether or not it would be a problem that when I got on the plane that my bags hadn't gone through those X-rays. So I went back and asked, and they said, oh, yeah, the bags have to go through the X-ray. But nobody had stopped me at the X-ray. They just let me walk past as if I was going to get on the plane. It's essentially an optional self-screening process. If you were a terrorist, you just wouldn't go through the optional self-screening process. It's madness.
Yeah, they might have stopped your bag from getting on board, though. You never know.
Wow.
That's true.
Well, I don't think Foz and I can speak to India, really. I've never been. Foz, you haven't been.
Nope.
Can't go.
I have not. I can. It's just a bit of a headache to go. I have to denounce my any affiliation with Pakistan and have to get it notarized and all sorts of paperwork, and then they might bless it.
Do you have a desire to go?
I'd like to go. I mean, there's some nice things to see, so I'd at least like to go once.
Well, we'll have to go through this blessing together.
Foz, you've been back to Pakistan several times, right?
Last time I was in Pakistan was when I was four.
Oh, I thought you'd been back more than that. I was going to say, the one thing that I keep seeing between that seems like fun to me is the border area between the two, where they do the performance and like raise and lower the flags.
We should include a video of that in the show notes because it does look pretty cool.
Yeah, I wanted to do that. The time before last that I went to India, the first time I went to India, I traveled around for almost a month with two of my closest Australian friends. And we went up, we rented a driver and we went up to, into Jammu and Kashmir on the Indian side. We didn't get to that part of the border, but we basically spent 3 days driving over the Himalayas, the Indian part of the Himalayas, on the final week before winter set in, that the pass was still open. And it's just mind-blowingly spectacular. There are these huge open desert, frozen desert plains and incredible peaks and little towns. And once we were up there, I mean, you know, we sort of spent sunrise at this remote little Tibetan monastery on a mountaintop. It's really, really, you feel like you're at the end of the world, but also in the middle of, I suppose, where millennia of armies have kind of sought to conquer and have marched past, and you're sort of near the Silk Route. I'd love to explore that part of the world more, and I wish it wasn't quite so perilous to explore Pakistan and Afghanistan and all through there.
Yeah, it would be nice. I think that there's some interesting things up in that area. I mean, the mountains look just from pictures, it's like, well, this is just a different part of the world that's unreal. We drive by mountains here, and it's like, oh, okay, there's a mountain, whoop-de-doo. But it's just like you're surrounded by just sheer cliffs, and you're at 10,000 feet, and you feel, you know, a little
small.
Sick. Yeah, you feel small. I mean, it's kind of incredible.
Well, part of those areas have glaciers, right? So, like, parts of Pakistan, glacier on the north end. I mean, it is really nice, and I'd love to go explore, but it's not really a safe place to be.
Yeah, yeah, the remote.
I mean, the beautiful part about India, and the reason why I want to keep going back, in spite of the fact that you go on a vacation to India and you come back home and you slump on the couch and go, oh my god, I need a vacation. apart from the fact that it's that sort of place, it's so diverse. Like when we were, I mean, Rajasthan is so different from the beaches in the south, which are so different, obviously, from the Himalayas in the north. It's like a little self-contained universe in its own right. I thought, and it's so colorful, and the smells and the flavors. And the explosive diarrhea. It's all over the place.
Did you get sick?
yeah. I think it's impossible not to. I was so grateful. I was in Australia. I was in Byron Bay, which is a beautiful resort town on the eastern side of the continent in Australia. And it was the day before I was leaving to go to India. And I realized I haven't bothered going and seeing a doctor about whether I should take anything with me. I'm just going there and assuming it'll be okay. So I went to a clinic and asked for some – is it Cipro? Yeah, Cipro, the antibiotic, the yep. kind of incredibly powerful antibiotic which people use – were stocking up on during the anthrax scare in 2001, and which just annihilates any tummy bug should you get it. And I thought, I'll just take it. They'll prescribe it for you prophylactically just as a precaution if you are going to a place like India. And on the final day when I had all of those – I hadn't been sick the entire time, but then I had these flights lined up. It was these back-to-back sort of one-hour domestic flights. From Ahmedabad to Mumbai to Delhi. And I'm not going to go into too much detail because some people might be eating while they're listening to this. But the rumbling began and I knew that things weren't going to be good. And I could just envisage being strapped into an Indian airline seat while we're on the tarmac and suddenly needing desperately to be in an environment that was not an Indian airline seat and having these back-to-back flights. So I popped the Cipro and it saved my life. But yeah, it was not pretty for a half day.
So you knew you were getting sick, but it was like, I'll take the Cipro and hopefully it'll take care of me.
No, it manifested itself considerably worse than that. There was a lot of there were a lot of liquids.
Ah, okay. Well, we won't go into more detail. But it sounds like, I mean, you made it home safe, which is good, and you're recording this now.
I survived. Yeah. You get an award for just surviving going to India. you don't get a T-shirt.
Oh man,
you got to skip that part of the trip.
Yeah,
exactly. If you had a driver, you were taken to at least three or four different shops where you had the opportunity to buy that sort of thing.
A trophy.
Yeah, exactly.
The T-shirt, the souvenir, whatever his cousin is selling.
So I mean, that's part of the travel, right? I mean, that's part of the fun. That's why we do all this. I don't want to go to a place where I'm only staying in the Four Seasons all the time, or I'm only staying. You know, I want to go to the places where there is a certain risk of getting a Delhi belly, as we call it, and such a.
I'm not opposed to going to places that I could get sick. I think it's the thought that of getting sick. I just dread that. Like the idea of being sick. I think I've been sick for the past 3 years every time we've gone to Europe together, guys. Every time. Even from Budapest.
To Europe? Why?
Yeah. Just coming down with the flu. Like I was miserable enough with the flu each trip that it's like, well, I can't imagine having food poisoning with this or having some other kind of intestinal distress while on the road. Like it just – that fact – it makes me weird, I know, but I just dread it. Like it would just – I don't deal well with that. Like just
I wouldn't – I mean I really wouldn't care about it in a developed country. Like in Europe, it doesn't really bother me. The problem in India is that it's the combination of intense heat, dustiness, you know, potential humidity, weird smells – you know, there being no level of luxury, at least the way that I travel there. So, like, there's no sort of comfort. There's no respite. Like, when I'm sick, all I want to do is be taken care of. And there's not a lot of being taken care of in India when you travel the way I do.
Yeah, it just sounds like constant nausea.
You could say that.
Well, I mean, just from what you're describing, like being dusty, having weird smells, being really hot, I would just be like, I just want to go back to the room and sit in front of the air conditioner. And
yeah, but the room is shitty too, so it's lose-lose.
I'm not being a very good, that's a nice thing to search for.
You haven't really sold me on India, so just gonna wait.
Just go. I mean, my philosophy, and I have the luxury of living in a continent that is far, I mean, hailing from a continent that is so far flung that I'm forced to think this way. But my philosophy is wherever you are stopping over, make it an interesting place to stop over and spend a bit of time there. And because Australia is so far from Europe and the United States, that gives me plenty of opportunities to stop somewhere in Southeast Asia or somewhere on the subcontinent or somewhere in the Middle East and just be like, you know what, why don't we take a week? And I encourage all of you and all of your listeners to do the same thing. You can't do that between JFK and Heathrow, but you can do it between lots of places.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good philosophy. I like it.
Yeah, you know, if given the right motivation, you can in fact stop in Iceland and the Faroe Islands and one or two other places between JFK. Right. You throw. And I only say that because I just did it. But, you know, it is not quite the same as India, that's for sure.
I think we have time for one last story. What do you guys think? Josh?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So, can we, go ahead.
I know it's not one of the ones we listed on that mention, but do you want to do the United Security questions instead?
Oh, yeah. Let's talk about that crap. So United has now completely moved over to this new system where you have to have a real true password. And you have to answer these security questions, and they're calling it two-factor authentication, which I have a lot of problems with because it's not really two-factor authentication. You're just asking me questions that use drop-downs. And the reason they're using the drop-downs is because they are worried about keyloggers and interdictions between your keyboard and their website, so people recording what you type. And so they remove the pen. And so this has created all kinds of headaches. I don't know about you guys, but I've tried to use the app now to buy a couple of tickets, and it keeps continuously logging me out every time I put in the answers to the questions, because it asks you the questions to validate the device, and they're stupid questions. Like, what's your favorite type of reading?
Braille.
Or I'm trying to think what's your favorite winter sport?
Pizza topping?
Pizza topping, yeah. Photography is one of the sports.
My favorite thing about the pizza topping question is that they mashed potatoes is apparently one of the answers. Oh, and in the FAQ for the security, someone's like, this is bullshit. How is mashed potatoes a thing? And they had to write back, no, really, we do that in Chicago. Which, I've been to Chicago several times and I've never seen mashed potatoes as an option on what they call pizza, which is to say the casserole sorts of things that they eat. But also, even if it's something that's special for Chicago, I just don't get it. I don't know.
Also, I never remember what I answered to these stupid things when they ask me the first time, I'm so frustrated that I think I'm really sticking it to the man by choosing something stupid. So I remember that I was asked the winter sports question and I chose curling as my favorite winter sport. But then
Josh, I'm just going to stop you here. Don't answer the other two on the episode because then you won't have any points left.
Good point. Excellent. But then I can never remember. But then I don't realize that when I'm making up stupid answers because I'm so frustrated with the system, the person who I'm actually hurting is future me, who then has to log in and is actually trying to remember what past asshole me was screwing around with when he was making up stupid answers. I think all of this is so dumb. We used to have, you know, all of these difficult logins at the last job that I was at, which were so complicated, and the password would have to be so complicated that everyone would just make their password capital P, lowercase askword, 123, exclamation point, question mark, or they would choose something so complicated that they'd never remember it, so they'd put it in a Word document entitled password and just put it on their desktop. That is not more secure. These things are being devised by morons who don't understand how people actually behave. Instead of, like, just make it reasonably easy but also secure for me to get into my account. This doesn't have to be Fort Knox.
I don't mind, like, a super secure password requirement. I don't mind that at all. I like to create unique passwords. I use a product I won't mention on the podcast because we're not sponsored by them. But I use the product to keep all my passwords in one place, and it's only on my device. Like, it's not stored on a server somewhere or anything. So that's great because it remembers my login to united.com. But I just found out that if you call – you have to provide the password via the phone system. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, how am I going to type in all this shit, excuse my language, on the phone? And it's a 22-character password. It's going to take me 5 minutes.
Would be lucky if you get to it in five.
Do you have to do that if it's on an authorized phone number?
Yes. It's how they verify. It's going to ask you to verify your account every time you call now. That's what the press release said.
But they've been, they clearly keep track of your phone number. So if it's a phone number associated with you, they shouldn't have to go make you do that.
Hey, I'm not.
You know how easy that is to spoof? Come on. If we're pretending that keyloggers are a real risk, spoofed caller ID's got to be also. This whole thing is we've gone from roughly zero security on Mileage Plus accounts to so far over the top amounts of security. I have no doubt that United lost some money or had, fraud issues. That there were large threads on Flyer Talk talking about the number of people that had their accounts compromised and points lost, and they had to put all the points back, and they generally the tickets were flown so quickly that the people got away with it. But at the same time, I feel like there's a middle ground somewhere. And
if you're going to have two-factor authentication, just do real two-factor authentication and send me a text message.
Yeah, that's my biggest complaint about this whole thing is that it's not actually two-factor authentication. If you're going to call it two-factor, actually have two-factor. Otherwise, you're just using buzzwords because you think people care.
Yeah.
But why is it – why does Chase – why is all of my money easier to get to than my frequent flyer miles?
It's true. I mean, this is to the point, and you look at airlines like Delta or Alaska, you're not required to jump through these hoops.
I would argue the reason your money is easier to get to than your miles because the back end systems are much better at detecting fraud and preventing it.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah, can't you hire the companies that are building those back end systems to make your system robust?
So you're going to hire a company that's done something in the last 5 years to go fix systems from 20 years ago?
Good point.
Or worse,
Chase existed 20 years ago.
But not their online presence.
Well, it probably has existed for as long as United's online presence has.
I would say Chase is probably a little newer. And remember, Chase has updated a lot of their backend systems where the airlines haven't because everything is so integrated with the old systems.
You seem to be giving the benefit of the doubt to people at United that there are reasons why they're behaving stupidly instead of...
I've stepped into data centers for airlines, and it is like walking into the Smithsonian.
Hey, I mean, that brings up the Delta outage, right? I mean...
Exactly. That's a perfect example. I mean, they literally, 10 years ago, not even 10, 7 years ago, there was a system that went offline, and it was for an airline that no longer exists. At the time, it was a 15-year-old system, which cost $2,000 at the time of purchase. It was doing all the weights and balances for the airline. System went down. They had no way to recover it because they had no backup hardware because it was so old. And so basically, you had people in there hodgepodging this thing back to life with defibrillators just so they could start dispatching flights again. And this is normal.
Why do you think this is particular to North American carriers? Because, I mean, it doesn't seem to be this clunky, this glitchy when I use other airlines' websites.
Well, also remember that we have the largest install. The user per number of flights, number of users is much larger on a U.S. carrier than any others.
Yeah, so that's a yes.
I would say I would not be surprised. I mean, I would say something like Lufthansa or BA, they are probably ahead of the curve because they use Amadeus. Right, because they let someone else handle all that, but the U.S. airlines. I mean, Delta uses WorldSpan for some things, but not everything.
Yeah, I don't disagree with Foz. Like the systems that the airlines are using are old. Like a lot of the back end stuff is mainframe esque stuff. And so
here, I'll give you a great story. So 6 years ago, I was in a data center for one of the airlines, and as my escort was taking me in there, he's like, "Just be warned, there's some old stuff in here." So this is about 6 years ago. So we walk in, and I stop in my tracks and my jaw drops and I look up, I go, I forgot that AT&T used to make PCs. And these were PCs actually in use for back-end operations.
And that gives
one of the major US airlines as recently as a few years ago was using an Access database to power large portions of its website.
Now that's scary.
I mean, and it was not critical functions on the website, but a significant number of the pages had information that was pulled from an Access database during the sales process.
And that's what makes the things like the outage from Delta so kind of infuriating for customers. I mean, I think Delta handled it mediocrely, and we can talk about that on another show. I think it was mediocre the way that they handled it all. Yeah. But what's infuriating is that the systems that they're running are not necessarily easy to get back up when they do go down because they are so old. And
I think there's a really interesting show in this that you guys should do sometime with some of your counterparts from other countries about why air travel in America is generally so much more miserable. I mean, I do think it's interesting when I have people who I've gotten used to it because I live here, and I think there are certain things that American carriers do quite well, obviously rewarding, well, up until recently, rewarding top-tier frequent flyers. I think they did better than airlines in other countries, and, you know, domestic business class is, first class is obviously better than European business class. But in general, when my Australian and Asian and European friends are flying domestically, they just marvel at me at how horrifying the experience is and how obedient and docile Americans are in terms of having come to accept it. I have an English friend who lives in Athens, who grew up in Germany, who was flying United and the flight was cancelled. And he said, all of the Americans, they reminded me of Soviet era East Germans lining up for borscht. They just accepted it. They didn't get angry or anything. There would have been a riot in Athens if this had happened.
But there would have been a riot if they just announced boarding, though. Let's be fair.
Well, it is Athens.
You know, similarly shocked that something good is happening, we rioted.
We set the streets on fire. Yeah. Anyway, it's an interesting concept. We might just have to do that. Find somebody from other countries and just talk to them about the experience. It'd be interesting to get someone from, say, Asia, someone from South Asia, India-esque, the Middle East, Europe, and just talk to them about their experiences as a frequent flyer. Even South America, I would say, would be a really interesting comparison.
Hey, listen, if any of our listeners want to be on the show and you think you can put up with our bullshit for 45 minutes.
Or an hour.
Hour.
We have time for one more question. Seth, you sent this to me, and so I will mention it here. Joel Freak on Twitter asked us, the in-flight mag, I think he was referring to the United in-flight mag.
No, he's Vietnam.
Vietnam Airlines? Is that who he said? Okay.
Yeah, Vietnam. So Vietnam, I can do it because I actually understood the question. Sorry.
Okay, there we go. You sent it to me, and I'm like, hey, I'm the host. That's I guess I should. That's
my idea what I was going to do. Vietnam Airways or Airlines is now partially owned by ANA. And is starting to do some harmonization with the ANA program in terms of code shares and some redemption options for the loyalty program. And so the question was, do we see that expanding beyond ANA Vietnam Airlines to also cover other Star Alliance partners with Vietnam Airlines?
I would say if it's one of the JVs, it's kind of hard to avoid, right? If it's one of the JV routes and code share numbers?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question is, will it be part of the United joint venture? The challenge there is they're a SkyTeam member.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know. I feel like there are enough sort of one-off partnerships outside the alliances or across alliances for whatever reason that I wouldn't expect anything to change dramatically. But I could see, you know, depending on how things go, ANA trying to pull them into Star Alliance if they thought it would make more sense or if they thought the joint venture would be more useful that way.
Yeah. I can't see them. I could see United saying, okay, we're fine with that. I could see this. I could see SkyTeam having a problem with it, though.
Well, sure.
I could see SkyTeam going, whoa, whoa, whoa. But then it's so now they're so in bed with each other because of the ANA owning part of them. Then that how do you? This is one of those issues where you can't avoid it. Like it's not going to be. Oh, we can distance ourselves. Well, part of the win for ANA in all this is that they own part of Vietnam Airlines and they want to use Vietnam Airlines to deliver customers. So
sure. And the challenge there is especially with the joint venture. Like, do you do United from New York to JFK, or sorry, from whatever Newark to Narita or Haneda or whatever, and then onward from there on ANA, and then onward on another hop on Vietnam Airlines to a country that's still part of the JV? Where does the money go at that point? Like, how does it get split?
Yeah, that's a good question.
The interesting, you know, the other one that you could look at though is Alitalia and Air Berlin are both partly owned by Etihad.
Yep.
So there is some precedence for airlines being in different alliances or owned partially by different companies and sort of it all being a mess anyways.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking at Berlin flights from Prague, that's served by the Etihad Air Berlin Saab 2000. And you were able to find Avios space on that. And that,
yeah.
It was kind of incredible because it's not actually like Air Berlin sells it, but it's not an Air Berlin flight number. It's an Etihad flight. I mean, it's actually Etihad crews and stuff. So I thought that was interesting. So you bring up a good point as with regard to that. So.
Yeah, I do wonder if some of these alliance memberships would start to shift because of that ownership. There was rumors, I don't know, they've been going off and on for a couple of years now that Alitalia is going to get out of the SkyTeam Transatlantic JV.
Interesting.
Whether they're going to leave it or be thrown out of it. And when the Etihad investment came, it was a whole lot of, no, we really like it here. It's good money for us and everybody's happy. But, you know, that was the public face. And privately, there's a lot of rumblings about they're a tiny portion of it. They don't see much profit. It doesn't deliver as many passengers as they wanted it to into the domestic-ish Alitalia network. Just a lot of challenges.
Yeah. Well, I think we don't really have the answer for.
I would say don't expect Star Alliance-ish stuff to change. Certainly not this year, and probably not for a while.
Yeah. And I will say one last note to Travis, who left us a comment on our last episode. We are going to reply to you. We want to cover your question. I think it's an interesting question. So don't give up. We just had a special guest this week, so we couldn't do it. But we'll do it next.
Sorry, Travis. It was all my fault.
It's all Josh's fault. But thanks for listening. Thanks for having Josh. Josh, you want to tell everybody where to find you online? And
yeah, you can follow me at Josh Zepps. That's JOSHZEPPS or ZEPPS. And the podcast, where three interesting people stand around at a bar in Brooklyn and banter about the week's news, is We the People Live, which you can follow at WTP_live on Twitter, or just search for it on iTunes.
Awesome. Thanks for listening, and happy travels, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.